Good afternoon. Welcome to the last day of Party Ed. Those that clap, I know what time you were out until last night. I'm Adam Tulliper, a software architect with Cegedim, and thank you for coming today. We have a lot of content to cover. Some of it is going to be basic intro to NLE Framework. We'll touch upon real briefly. I'm going to assume that you have some existing NLE Framework knowledge. If not, hopefully the quick refresher will be enough for you. We're going to concentrate more on MVC. We are going to hit web forms, though, so we won't leave web forms hanging out there in the cold either. There's my Twitter handle. I promise not to spam you with tweets every 5 minutes. I'm pretty good about doing only important content out there. And my blog, completedevelopment.blogspot.com. Pluralsight.com author, if you have interest in ASP.NET security for web forms or MVC, check that out. And any question, comments, gift cards, beer, etc., contact me, adam.tulliper@gmail.com. I want you to get the most that you can out of the session today. I'll be hanging out a little bit afterwards if you have any questions. If anything you think of later, feel free to shoot me an email. All right, the important slide, the first one, the techno babble. It's got to be some useless slide to try to confuse you and get you to use a new technology. So this one is your current effectiveness using an ORM versus not using an ORM, only in conjunction with the price of rice in China versus effectiveness. Now, while you ponder that for a moment, let's go on. Why NLE Framework? It is extremely fast setup. Anybody who has written data access code knows it can be an absolute pain. You're lucky if you get code generation templates in place. Otherwise, it's just this repetition over and over. And then you're like, well, how do I want to handle my keys and relationships? Do I want to do lazy loading? If somebody loads up a customer, do I want to load all the orders at once? Or do I want to do it on demand? These are all questions we've asked ourselves at various times. Validation, do I want to roll my own? Do I want to integrate with something like web forms, you know, page.isValid or validators on there? So there's lots of decisions that we think about as every project comes up. NLE Framework has all the support built in, so you no longer have to worry about this. It's smart. If you change a customer first name, that is the field that gets sent back to the database. One of the advantages of using parameterized queries is that it can just send that one field in a SQL statement back to the database. All major database engines are supported, so if you're not running SQL Server and you need something else, the support is there. Otherwise, all versions of SQL Server are supported. And no SQL injection. I talk about SQL injection a lot on the security side. People think, well, isn't that an old attack? Doesn't that not really happen much anymore? Depending on which statistic you look at, it's still the number one or number two attack. So by default, NLE Framework uses parameterized queries, and they are not vulnerable to SQL injection. And the API to use it is very easy, too. You have this DBContext API they added. Code first, which we'll get into. Enum support is now there in NLE Framework 5. I'll install the pre-release here, but we're not going to use NLE Framework 5 specific features, but I will install it because it is available if you want to get the release candidate out there. So what is a real web application? I should call these more enterprise applications, because real web applications, all right, you develop an application, clearly it's a real application. I just consider the samples that I found on the internet while learning about NLE Framework to be inadequate for larger applications, more organized applications. Anything that is a basic prototype or basic CRUD, use the templates that are out there. Use the techniques that you find out on the blogs. Your boss says to you, you have approximately 36 seconds to come up with a customer edit page. Feel free to go ahead and use the built-in support for maybe all your code inside of one project. Those applications are quick, dirty, in a separate category themselves. We're talking more about enterprise applications, more developers, layered applications where we don't want all of our code inside of one project. Clearly has separate layers. We want to separate out a web, data access layer, et cetera. Any applications where we start getting more complex logic, complex views, how many of you in your web forms, you know, your code was like this because it just went everywhere, or your MVC views got really dirty. So we want to try to organize your data access routines here a bit. And applications that can benefit from dependency injection can really work well here. By this week and sometime, I'll have an entry up on the blog for dependency injection with NLE Framework, so check that out. Now let's go over a brief list before we start looking at code on everything that you'll need to get up and running. Clearly, install NLE Framework. And that's very easy, using the Package Manager console, and I'll show you that. You can just do install-package NLE Framework. If you want to do real basic integration testing and not have to go against a full database server. SQL CE is a nice alternative. You can also do binary deployment. Maybe your hoster doesn't support SQL Server. You can actually just throw up your libraries for SQL CE and run it there. I find SQL CE to be great for integration testing, where I can create my database when my unit tests start, an integration test, and it deletes it when it's all done. No impact on any other environment. The SQL Compact Toolbox, if you're going to use SQL CE, is very nice for that. Integrates with Visual Studio and works well with Entity Framework. The absolute must, though, is Entity Framework Power Tools. That is not part of Visual Studio yet. I believe eventually it will be. They still have a lot of changes coming out for that. That's available on CodePlex. That is a must download. And the Mini Profiler. That is a free application from the guys from Stack Exchange. You've all heard of like stackoverflow.com. And I'll show you that briefly, too. Create your projects in layers. And this is clearly, this is a suggestion. You might have different ways of doing this internally, but you want your web and your data access layer separate. I have a domain layer in this project. It doesn't mean I'm doing domain-driven development or design. It just represents some business entity. And a test project if you want some. Some people like a service layer and a business logic layer as well. That's for your organization to decide, but these are just the basics I'll talk about today. Next step is clearly you want to design and create your entity. What's an entity? Your customer object, your order object. Add your validation. Validation's cool. We all want validation. Handle concurrency. That was a pain before. Entity Framework makes that nice, and we'll check that out at the very end. And the repository pattern for all CRUD. So how many of you right now are using your repository pattern for anything? Excellent. That's more than I had hoped for, more than I thought. I hope for everybody. Okay, so three important terms. The context. The context, let me switch over because I've got a funny little slide here. You're going to say it's very dry and cheesy, and you're going to find out about my sense of humor being awful. Little Nancy was in the garden filling in a hole when her neighbor peered over the fence. Interested in what the girl was up to, he politely asked, "What are you up to there, Nancy?" "My goldfish died," replied Nancy tearfully, without looking up, "and I've just buried him." The neighbor was concerned, "That's an awfully big hole for a goldfish, isn't it?" Nancy patted down the last heap of earth and replied, "That's because it's inside your stupid cat." So it is all about the context. Context is very important. And in Entity Framework, it is everything. It is the spork of your command, connection, and transaction. You had all these separate objects before. It's all now handled. All your CRUD operations must go through your context. If you want to get something or save something, it goes through that context class. That's everything. And it parties after midnight because Honey Badger don't care. And if you don't get that reference after this session, please, YouTube Honey Badger. POCO, plain old CLR objects. This is a play on the POJO or POHO term from Java. And plain old CLR objects, they're basic classes. And we'll look at how simple they are. And entity states, we won't cover much here, but it's important to know. If you create a new object and you haven't yet given it to the context to do anything with, what is it? It's a detached object. It doesn't know anything about it. If you say, here, I'm adding a new object, that entity state is added. If you don't make any changes after loading it to your database, it's unchanged. If you change a property, it's modified. So the states make sense, and you probably have written stuff like this in your applications using like isDirty flags, items like that. This is all now built into the Entity Framework. So a quick background on POCOs. Some people say, isn't it the same as a DTO, data transfer object? They look basic. They have just a bunch of properties in them. So aren't they the same? And there's a few differences here. Both of them are 100% persistent ignorant, and this is very important. In the past, patterns were when you created a customer object, you would have a method like customer.save, and then some data access code. Well, now, think of these entities as free-floating. They don't know anything about persistence. You want to give them to someone else to save, or you want to get them from somewhere else. The entities themselves, they're just these little innocent guys floating around. They don't know anything about it. So your POCOs can absolutely contain business logic, though, just not persistence. And they should not reference any framework implementations outside of the .NET base class library. You want them, again, to be free-floating, portable between layers. DTOs are made to transfer data between layers, maybe a service layer, et cetera. Both of them, again, know nothing about persistence, which is very important. And DTOs just transfer state between layers. We won't need that with Entity Framework, as we'll see. Model first, database first. Let's load up these points, and then we'll look at some code. You have several options with doing Entity Framework. How many are you right now using Entity Framework? Perfect. So we'll breeze over this quickly then. Model first, database first. You basically take your database and you import it in your project and it creates your models for you in this visual design. It's easy code regeneration. You can just right-click and refresh your database or add a new table to it. Very fast implement. Some people don't like to deal with an EDMX file. What happens if a coworker has it checked out, and then you check in and have to merge this XML file? So some feel that there's a loss of control by using an XML file to define your entities. People want to see pure code, and we'll look at that shortly. So let's go over and look at some code samples here. All right. So installing Enly Framework, right down here, install package Enly Framework. If you're wondering how to get to that, tools, library, package manager, and you want to load package manager console. Very powerful. NuGet packages are the bomb. Install dash package Enly Framework, and I'm using dash pre. This is going to install the Enly Framework 5 libraries. And there's something interesting to note about the EF5 libraries. If you're running this from Visual Studio 2012, your library version, if you're wondering, is going to be 5.0. Hey, it's the 5.0, run. Anyway, version 5. If you are using Visual Studio 2010, it's going to show up as version 4.4. And they had to do that because of supporting different features with different API. They are both version 5, though. One just applies to .NET 4.5. One applies to .NET 4. So even though there's two version numbers, they're both Enly Framework 5. All right. Let's go ahead and do a add new item, and we're going to do data, and we only care about this one right here. So we have data and ADO.NET Enly data model. We don't care about any of this for now. And this is going to give us our nice little EDMX. We can see the bottom model1.edmx, and it's going to say, hey, where do you want this to come from? We're going to generate from a database. I have an Enly Framework demo database set up. So we'll next through this, and we're going to see our tables. And I'm just going to select a couple tables here. Something important I want you to note. I have a customer and an order. An order contains a customer ID. So that's one sort of join. Secondly, I have a join table for customer and customer address and customer address join. Because I want you to see how Enly Framework generates the entities. So just remember, we're doing two join types here. This has a customer ID. And for addresses, we're going through a join table. We finish and compile after it shows us our diagram. And there we have our entities. So this is great for architectural documentation. It's visible. This is nice. It's easy to see what's going on. Now, the problem that I have here so far so we're going to create a context. And let's say context.customers.first. Actually, let's just create a customer object. And I just want to go to definition, because I want to show you the difference with a POCO and not POCO. Here is our customer object. And frankly, it's pretty ugly. Here's a property just for customer ID. So there's a lot of code there. I want clean classes. I want POCO classes. So the first thing before I do anything else, after compiling, go back to your model and right-click. And first note here, code generation strategy. That says you want to generate the stuff from your EDMX file. But I'm going to add, right-click, add code generation item. And in here, I'm going to say context. Enly Framework 4.x DB context generator. This allows us to work with a newer DB context API. And this changes code generation strategy from default to none and installs a template here. And now we see, let's compile this. Now we have a customer object here that we can actually see. And if we look at it, it's much cleaner. So these are our POCO items. Very, very clean and plain. This is what I want to see. Now with Enly Framework 5, when the real version, full version comes out for Visual Studio 2012, this will happen automatically. DB context will be generated by default. If you're using 2010 or the release candidate, then you have to still use the template for it. Now, querying is extremely simple, and we'll just do this real quick. We'll say for each, I'm going to loop through every customer in here. Console.WriteLine, customer.FirstName. compile it, and and run it. So I've now just generated the model, generated code, and loaded all my data. It happened real quick there if you didn't see it. Console.readline, so we get a little pause. So that took us, what, like a minute or so, and we have a complete working data access layer, and we don't have to worry about any of the other details associated with it. So this is using database first and using this EDMX. When you make changes to the database, you have to come in here and update your model from the database, and it's always sourced from your database down. Let's go over and talk about the other option that we have available to us, code first. And when I'll be honest, when I first heard about code first, I heard you can generate your database from your code, and I thought, why would I ever on earth do that? I'm in an enterprise environment, and databases already exist. Or maybe, all right, if I'm doing a new application, I could do that, but I'm used to doing a SQL scripts for it. And we'll see at the end some nice changes that came in 4.3 that make this a lot easier. So code first, though, you get these POCO objects by default. You can specify initializers that will create a database, delete a database for you. Why would you ever do that? Again, you could do that. For me, the power is in unit and integration testing. I can say when my test harness starts up, Entity Framework, create my database for me based on my code. Run some tests, and when you're done, delete it, clean it up, it's all good to go. And you get this nice API that's very easy to read, the Fluent API for validation, and we'll look at that shortly. Some people don't like the fact there's no visual designer, but we can get around that using the Entity Framework Power Tools. If you want a snapshot for architectural documentation purposes, you want to see your entities, you can still generate that model using the Power Tools, and I'll show you that. Now, there's no direct stored procedure support. In our EDMX model, you can map to stored procedures through the visual designer. So you lose that control with code first, but I'll show you it's very easy to get around in a very powerful way. It requires only your context class and a model, and that's it. And the thing that sold me on code first, again, was the power tools. Once I found out you can reverse engineer an existing database and create your code and have a starting point, that was where the power, that's where I saw the power at. So let's switch over, and I'll show you some code first. And I can actually reuse most of the basic code. I'm just going to delete all of this. And I'm going to come in here and right-click. After you install the Entity Framework Power Tools, you get this Entity Framework menu. So this is not part of the base install. Reverse engineer code first. Cool. Localhost indeed. Show me my databases. Entity Framework demo. Same database I used before. Now, this does a bunch of stuff magically for me. It'll take a second here. This is parsing the database. It's parsing my data types in the database. Validation rules. For instance, if I have varchar 50, it's parsing that. And it creates these classes with that information involved. So here's the meat of everything. One thing it does right now is you get like sysdiagrams created by default. I don't care about sysdiagrams. So just to clean this up, I'm going to delete that. And I'm going to delete that here. Just to clean this up a little. So we've got our customers, we can see. Customers is a set of customer. Customer address is a set of customer address. So this is our context. This defines we have a customer and customers. It's very, very basic. Let me compile this. It's going to fail at first because the name of our context is now Entity Framework Demo Context. We see it right here. Compile it, and when I look at these objects that were created, these are POCO by default. These are nice, lean, mean, fighting machine POCO objects. Now, what are these mapping classes? These are all of the attributes for validation and keys, and it keeps it separate for us. So let's open up one of these map files, and we can see this is the Fluent API, how clear it reads. We see the primary key is customer ID, and you can read this almost like VB. First name is required and has a max length of 50. I should say a children's storybook, right? Last name is required, max length of 50. What's everybody laughing at? Come on. Another cool thing you can do here. You and your DBA might not agree on column names. I like to have a key everywhere in the table itself and everywhere else called customer ID. I don't want to call it ID there and customer ID somewhere else. I like consistent names. But if your DBA has a database or an old legacy database, we have this huge database at work that everywhere the key is called unique underscore ID. Sometimes it's just unique ID. That's no problem. You can just map it here. And you're saying that's going to map to my customer ID, but you're going to come from unique ID in the database. So your code can be clean. Your database can be messy. And you can help clean that up using that. So this map class just defines everything about your class. And it keeps it separate, nice and clean. And we can run the same project using the same code we did with our database first model. And everything works just fine. Now, like I said before, everything goes through the context. So if I want to update anything here, I can just simply say customer.firstname equals plus equals. We'll make everybody's name exciting. We'll add an exclamation point to it. John, Mary. And run this, and run that. And it's actually making the changes afterwards. In fact, the one thing I forgot here, after talking about how important the context was, you have to actually, this doesn't save anything. When you're all done making changes, you call context.saveChanges. And then it will take all of those changes you just did in kind of like a unit of work pattern and send those all over at once. Now, if we actually run this again, we're going to see everybody has exclamation points after their name. They were saved to the database. So just like that, we've updated the database as well. Very easy, very fast. So that was code first. We reverse engineered an existing database. Very powerful to me. The basic architecture of the website we'll look at, something I touched upon briefly, focus only on the orange for now. We have a website, a domain project, data access project. In our data access project, we're going to take out our implementation of the Entity Framework. It's not going to go on our website. It's not going to go in our domain. It's a specific implementation. It goes in that data access class, that project. And in there, we use the repository pattern. And I will cover the repository pattern for those that aren't using it yet. Use the repository pattern. Now would be a good time to talk about the repository pattern. What is a repository pattern? Other people define it better than me. So the important parts here, it's an abstraction. Provides us with persistent ignorance, meaning our other classes don't care what you do with it. We're going to give it to you, dear repository class. The responsibility of persisting our objects is encapsulated by the repository, thus leaving our domain objects, our customer object, our order object, to deal entirely with the model and the logic. Shouldn't care about saving it. That's the repository's concern. And looking at the code here, I've defined a repository interface with some common, I use generics here. Some people prefer generic repositories, some don't. Here's some common methods I want all of my repositories to implement. Delete, get all, create, update, save. And then I define a class, a concrete implementation of that interface. And here, get by ID. And we use that same context class. And we just do a nice query here. Return customer.single, where customer ID equals whatever we passed in. Now, an interesting point here. Anybody know the difference with single versus first? First will give you a top one. It will give you the first record. Single actually attempts to query top two. And if there's more than one return, give you an exception. So you are explicitly stating here, only one should be returned, and I want you to enforce that rule. Now, for those who get into fights all the time with their DBA or love stored procedures or want to use them, I prefer very complex loading, et cetera, can still go into a stored procedure just fine. You don't have to use parameterized queries. And using the repository pattern, this makes it extremely easy to swap out. So maybe your DBA says, hey, you better implement this procedure. No problem. Go into your repository, comment that out. Uncomment or add a line. Off of your context, you can reference a database object, .SQL query. And even more powerful with the integration with Entity Framework is you can say, I want to return a customer. Your procedure doesn't need to know anything about a customer object. What it's going to do is going to look at the fields returned and map those by name into your customer object and hand you a customer object back. It's a perfect way to hydrate an object from a stored procedure. If the implementation changes, no problem. You come in here and you change it. It's very easy. Yes? If So the question was, returning multiple result sets, if you have a single customer with multiple orders. I haven't tried it in a stored procedure. In that case, what I would have done is, when I query my entity, I would have said, come in here, customers dot include orders, or whatever other tables that you want to include on there. To be honest, I haven't tried it through a stored procedure, but I'll check that out. I check back on my blog in a couple days. I'll look through that. All right, so going back to the PowerPoint, sorry for the switching around here, we have repository pattern. It's swappable. Why would you ever swap out your data access implementation? You're using SQL Server. A very fair question here, outside of testing and testability and mocking purposes, you might go to Azure. You might go to somewhere on the cloud. It might require a slightly different data access layer. Or you might have an Azure version and a local version. You'd have a different implementation of your data access here, and it's easily swappable using a repository pattern. As we saw with a stored procedure, it's a single point of change. So something interesting here with websites that you want to keep in mind is that take your collections to an IE enumerable first. All right, what does that mean? And it's kind of a slightly misleading statement. Here, let me get IEnumerable customer, customers. This applies to MVC and web forms. And I'm going to say customers. Oh, I'm sorry. Maybe I didn't want you to see it yet. Customers, context, customers. Let me move this out up here. And move this up here. So I'm saying give me the customers. And here I'm just going to say for each customer in customers. Okay. The code compiles fine. I'm getting the customers. And outside of my context, I'm enumerating through them. And when we run this, it's going to blow up on us. Anybody hear those choppers going overhead earlier? They were crazy sounding. Stealth. All right. Invalid operation exception cannot be completed because the DB context has been disposed. And when you start doing applications, web applications with this, you find this out very quickly, that you want to convert to either to list or to array first. And when you do that, this works fine. Why? Because Entity Framework uses deferred execution, meaning when you first reference context.customers, it doesn't do anything as of that point in time. In fact, if I set a breakpoint here and use IntelliTrace, watch once we come here. Oh, hold on a second here. Customers, let me set that right there. So before I call this, how about I change this from back to just here again? And we'll run this down to there. Now notice, IntelliTrace will tell you the query that gets executed for Entity Framework. There's nothing here yet. But now, when I go ahead and I call to list or to array, as soon as I execute that line, you can see the query was executed right there. So it forces the execution now as opposed to deferred execution, which can get you into trouble later. So my repositories always will return. If I'm returning all, get all, and you can see I'll convert to array and return IEnumerable, because IEnumerable is a nice lowest common denominator to return from a repository pattern. Yes? What's that? There's a big debate with iQueryable. iQueryable leaves itself open to several things. One, it's... Is Godzilla outside? King Kong? It's part of my presentation. They brought King Kong along. iQueryable has various implementations depending upon the provider. Entity framework might work different than a different link provider. So it's hard to test it. Now, also, you get deferred execution with it. Your execution doesn't take place in your repository. It executes later on when some other caller uses it. So the debate here is, in a repository, if you have some basic methods that you want to return that fit these scenarios, or maybe a couple others, maybe load by first name, load by last name, that's fine. Some people ask the question, what happens when I start loading by like 50 parameters? In those cases, I can understand the argument why somebody wants to return iQueryable. They have a little bit more dynamic querying. For me, I prefer to try to keep everything in the repository so I know that nobody outside of this repository is loading the data in other ways that are hard to test or hard to figure out or deferred execution, et cetera. What's that? I'll make extra methods, yeah. Yep. So you want to go to two list or two array first. In web applications, do not cache your context. Don't think about performance with the context. Create a new one per request. And on a separate kind of unrelated note with Entity Framework, I just wanted to include this on here. If you're looking at supporting, maybe in your repository layer, different implementations between Azure or SQL CE, the universal membership providers from Microsoft support all their databases. So you can download those, use those in your application, and it's very portable amongst all the various database systems. All right, let's get into MVC here. With views, all the examples you see and the scaffolding built into MVC allows you to generate using a customer object, it will create your create, edit, delete views for you. So you're leaking out this domain object into your presentation layer. Sometimes that gets tricky. When your application starts getting more advanced and lots of properties, you might accidentally be displaying fields to a user that you're not expecting. Or on the flip side, they might be posting fields back as an attacker, as a hacker, you're not expecting to go into your object. So it's a recommended consideration that you want to use view models. And a view model is nothing more than a class that you create that you're going to populate with your own data and send it off. Sometimes it might look exactly identical to your domain object. Sometimes it might be different. You might start including select list items in there and other arrays you're going to use in your view. You'll find that as the application gets more complex, you'll thank yourself for using a view model and not trying to hack around working with an entity. Now, again, if your boss says, hey, you've got a half hour to write something, and you can just right-click in MVC and use the scaffolding templates, so be it. I'm talking about more advanced applications here. All right, so let's look at, go back here, and let's look at what the view models are in MVC. And switch over. I'm going to close out a repository and go into our controller method. First, I'm going to show you our index method. We're going to load all of our customers from the database and display them. And the code for that, while that loads, looks like this. I have my repository, which here I'm using dependency injection. And the advantage of dependency injection with MVC is I don't have to worry about managing the lifetime of my repository. I'm saying, dear Unity or whatever your IOC container is, give me a concrete implementation of my repository, and when I'm done with it, dispose it for me. I don't want to have to worry about lifetime and making sure I dispose it and all that. Hand it to me, and away we go. So that's how I get my repository here. I use Unity. And the index method gets all the customers. So these are now my domain objects. These are my entities. I have a list of customer. I want to map them to a view model. What's my view model look like? It's everything I'm going to display here. It's very basic. It is an extremely lightweight class here, customer ID, first name, last name, and all that. And that's what shows up here. How do you map between one or the other? Well, in this case, I'm just saying for each of my customers, create a new view model using this lambda expression and just copy the properties over. Very easy. There's another alternative as well. You can use AutoMapper. AutoMapper is a great tool. And on Jimmy Bogard's blog, the creator of AutoMapper, you can find some code for the AutoMap attribute. And it looks like you're returning a customer object right to the view. But if I look at my view, I get this great cool view navigation with ReSharper here. Edit, hop right to my view, and I can see that I'm actually displaying a customer edit view model, not a customer object. Remember, I'm not letting my entities leak out onto my page. I'm only just using this lightweight customer edit view model class. And what happens using aspect-oriented program, AOP, is I'm telling this attribute that after my method runs, take this customer object, and we can see right here, it surely is a customer object. And when you get that customer object, automatically convert it to a customer edit view model. So I don't have to include this copying of properties all inside my class. It's very powerful, and it works great. And when I edit a customer, we can see it works just fine. In fact, let's remove the exclamation point because Mary's not that exciting. All right. Sorry, Mary. Just being honest. What's that? Well, in that case, then you would do like a take 10. You would implement some sort of paging mechanism in your repository layer. You would be able to pass in a parameter for which page that you want, and you can do paging built in that way. I don't. I mean, I have small records here. But in that case, so you just say get by page, and you pass in a page number and change your query to take a page number and take the next 10. Nope. It won't change the entity at all. Because you're still just returning some collection. You're letting the query take care of what to return, and you're still just getting some number of entities back you're going to map out to your page. You'll have to store what page number you're on inside of your view. And when the user clicks next, you're just going to say, all right, I'm at 5, pass 10 back now. Pass 15, grabbing the next 5, grabbing the next 5. It wouldn't be, but you can tell in your framework to grab like next. You can go next whatever, next whatever, next whatever. Come up afterwards and find me after. Just make sure we get through everything here. DB context is not thread safe. So as I said before, one per request. Dependency injection makes this very easy to do. If you're not using dependency injection, instantiate it in your controller and make sure you have a dispose method and you are done at the request. Do not cache it. Don't keep it around. It's not thread safe. You'll start getting weird issues with various threads adding entities to it. Don't try to do it. Let the performance up to it, one per request. So dispose your context when all done. And please, don't throw all your entity framework code into a controller. When you start using MVC, some of the practices that people did in web forms comes over, and you start getting what used to be in a code behind, which was a bad practice anyway, starts making your controller code large. Think. Controller code should be thin and organized. The controller method that I had for my edit was 2 lines of code. So greatly reduce what's in there and keep that in mind. The controller's purpose is just to orchestrate something to hand it off to your presentation layer. And if it's complicated, it should call off to some other layer to get it. Now with web forms, let me set my web forms project here. You can use some of the built-in objects there, entity data source, object data source. I prefer to always controlling the connections by myself. Otherwise, you know, you're going to these real web applications, but you're letting these essentially black box controls handle the lifetime of everything for you. So as I said before, data binding needs to occur in your context scope. This can get tricky when you use the other data sources. So, stick with the repository pattern. You can still use the repository just fine inside of Web Forms application, and I'll show you a demo of that. Please, don't think about caching or putting your entities in the view state. And if you're binding your entities, be very careful, because making sure that doesn't end up in a view state. If you have a customer object with a million orders, your view state could end up just bringing down Tokyo. The cool thing now with ASP.NET 4.5 is you have these strongly typed controls, which you didn't have previously. It's one of the reasons I loved MVC, strongly typed views, model binding. Now with ASP.NET 4.5, you can use view models easily. Let's switch over here. And all right, so I've just got a real generic project here. It does this. Essentially a very similar thing. We instantiate a repository. We load all of our customers. we map it to a view model. Same thing that we did in MVC, you can now do in web forms. And then here you bind it. Same way of mapping here, using your Lambda and the actual code. With ASP.NET 4.5, you can do your strongly typed controls like that, and you get IntelliSense now here, which is neat too. So you didn't have that before. So that makes the pattern a little bit better. I like the 4.5 implementation more now, and I think it's a little bit cleaner. And the data binding is the same way. So you can still use that. You can clean up your web forms code a little bit. It doesn't have to be completely messy. You don't have to have all the stuff smashed in there, all your data access code. You can still use the repository pattern just fine, just like I did here. Don't throw all that entity code into your code behind. Same principle here. Keep it as thin as possible and lean and mean. Validation. With MVC and web forms, you can both get all three options for server-side validation. We looked at the Fluent API earlier. That's what the Entity Framework Power Tools generated for us. It was very easy to see, very easy to read. You have data annotations, which are attributes. Of course, I'll show you these in 1 second here. And for custom validation, which is a common question, you can use iValidatable Object Interface, which has one method, validate, and I'll show you that as well. When do these validations occur? Anytime you call save changes in your context, it looks for these implementations, and it will validate all of its internal data. When it fails validation, the Entity Framework will throw DB Entity Validation Exception, which allows you to do kind of some nice catching in web forms and MVC. I like the MVC integration a bit more because we can implement a global action filter to catch all those exceptions. In MVC 4, the Fluent API, those validation exceptions are caught automatically by MVC 4. And if you're using MVC now, model state is valid, will be false. MVC 3 did not do that. I have an action filter in this project I'll show you that allows us to integrate that with MVC 3 as well. So let me go over to our MVC project. To look at the validation options, actually, let me just simplify this a little bit. And in our basic application that we had here, let's undo what I did earlier here. And we just wanted to enumerate through all of our customers and change the first name, context, context.saveChanges, set a breakpoint here. Now, let's go ahead and change our validation options. On our customer map object, this is our Fluent validation, Fluent API. So if we want max length of 5, let's change that. Well, what's going to happen now, we're assigning an exclamation point, and when we save it, it's going to validate these rules and say, hey, you violated this rule. You have names that are greater than 5. Now notice, it doesn't happen yet. I've already assigned all these names. As soon as I call save changes, and we see DB entity validation exception. If we look at the details, you can see that it does it to 43 records. So it does all these validations at once. You don't have to worry about one, then the next, and the next. It says all these guys have issues. So it's nice if you want to log them all out, all your issues. That was using the Fluent API. And there's other things that you can do. So has max length, is required, is variable length. You can specify different properties there. Let's get rid of the is required and has max length. And let's convert these to using data annotations instead. So let's go over to our actual object and say first name is required. And some people like data annotations. They think that this reads a little bit easier, and that's fine too. It works with both. Max length of 5. So that's nice and visible as well. Both options work just great. And if I run this project, save changes, and the same exact thing is going to happen. DB entity validation exception on a whole bunch of rows, 43 rows. So that's the second option, data annotations. Both server-side, both called on safe changes. The third option, using iValidatable Object Interface. Let's look at that implemented in a web application. I have that on my view model. You can do this in several places. It doesn't have to go on your entity. If you want to do server-side validation, you can do this on a view model. So my customer create view model, I can implement it there. Or I could take this code out and put it on my customer class as well, either way. In this particular case, there's only one method here for iValidatable object. It's the validate method. And you do your validation checks in here, and you return new validation results. So I know that this is just a really basic test that says if the email address is test@nowhere.com, return false, which then adds validation result. Email address is already registered. And let's see what this looks like when we run it. This was on our create customer. Just create new. And I think I have some value stored in here. Sunny, email address test@nowhere.com. When we create, let's go ahead and debug into this. I can close that window and just save this guy. And we wait for it. And I'll preempt by going to Visual Studio and wait. There we go. If we look at the... pop back in there. Thank you very much. So this is going to return email addresses already registered. With MVC, this was on my view model. So I didn't actually even call any save changes on my context yet. And that's one way of doing this. Let me show you the code on my customer controller. What I mean here. When I created a customer, MVC hands me this view model, already populated, one of the awesome things about MVC. Let me try this again. I create, okay, I'm at my breakpoint. My controller hasn't even been called yet. MVC's model binder calls this interface for us. And it says, our model state is not valid. It's kind of like page.isValid equals false. And we just return. We don't do anything with that. Now, like I said, we could also move the same code onto our entity itself and simply have the validation there. Both options work fine with iValidatable object. The point just being, I want to show you that you can have a third option for custom validation on the server side. And I'm sure you can roll your own schemes beyond that, but these three are fairly standard and they work just great for you. Client-side validation. This is a big debate. I've seen posts on Stack Overflow, very, very skilled people who say, I will not do client validation ever. I only rely on server-side. Other people love client-side validation. So I just want to give you some information here. With client-side validation, for MVC, if you want your attributes to end up being validated on the client side, you must use data annotations. WebForms 4.5 now supports data annotations. Remember, those were those attributes required, max length, etc. And those will equate out to HTML5 attributes, which actually work for prior browsers as well. And it will use jQuery unobtrusive validation and validate when you do your post. Outside of that, there's no real tight integration. The Fluent API attributes and anything from iValidatable object, these are server-side only validation options. So you're kind of limited on client-side. Of course, you can do your own custom validation as well. But data annotations make it out. Now, if you are using view models, remember that your data annotations must go on your view model in order to make it out to your web page. If you have data annotations only on your entity object and you convert that object to a view model, you're not going to get your client-side validation. So whatever object is going out to your page, that's the one that requires your data annotations on it, and the runtime will parse it and create the proper attributes on the page. Concurrency. This was a pickle earlier. You create a record, and you would have something on there like last change, last modified date, and you had to roll this into your code. How many here have ever manually done concurrency code? Right? A lot of people. It's not fun. Now, with Entity Framework and SQL Server, you can do some cool stuff. You can say you have a timestamp attribute and using a built-in row version or timestamp type on SQL Server. Let's go forward here a little bit. Okay. When Entity Framework detects that there's some concurrency issue, it's going to throw DB update concurrency exception. Now, with MVC, again, we can catch this from a global action filter. And with web forms, we have to kind of manually catch this, and I'll show you that in a second. So the steps here, in your database, Godzilla is getting angry. There are some strange noises outside of this place. Helicopters and gunshots. All right, so you can create a timestamp field here. If everybody can't see that, okay. I have my customer object, and I have this timestamp field created. And internally, it basically is a binary, a byte array. And every time you save that object, internally, SQL Server increments that byte array. You don't have to do anything for it. It automatically is self-incrementing. So the way that Entity Framework uses that is when you load up your view, let's go to, let's edit this, edit Mary. And I want to show you my view. So customer edit view model. I have a timestamp. It's a byte array going out to the page. On my entity itself, my customer entity, you can see I've noted. I'm sorry, let me go to my, here we go. Right here. I've said that is a timestamp. So I'm telling Entity Framework I'm using this for concurrency. Third, the only other thing you really need to do here is, of course, make sure that timestamp ends up on your page, otherwise it's never used. And on my views, customer edit, I just simply include that timestamp as a hidden field. Model.timestamp. And you can name that field whatever you want. I just called it timestamp. It could be last updated, whatever. But it is the timestamp type or row version, depending on which version of SQL Server you're using. And then what happens, if we do show our hidden fields, we can see Mary's customer ID there. This is the serialized byte array behind the scenes. And when we save it, let's do something cool here. I talked earlier about the mini profiler. It used to be called the MVC mini profiler. Free tool, again, by the guys from Stack Exchange. And girls, I don't want to exclude anybody here, from the people at Stack Exchange. And it gives you the ability to profile your code in multiple ways. You can do it however you want. You can sprinkle your own profiling code in there, or the reason I like it is by default, it will log your Entity Framework queries for you. Now, Entity Framework queries for the majority of situations are quite nice. If you get into very complex joins and you're finding that your SQL just doesn't look right, or it just seems too messy for you, maybe there's a reason, or you have an existing other procedure, go ahead and pull that code out and put it into a separate procedure. I showed you earlier how easy it was to use a repository pattern to simply change from a normal Entity Framework implementation to call a store procedure. That's no problem. You can do both in a very happy world. But what I just wanted to show you here was the mini profiler shows you those queries, and I highly recommend checking them just to make sure it's doing what you expect it to see. Free tool. And there's a NuGet package that will install it as well. And also, as I showed you, you can use IntelliTrace, and that will show you the Entity Framework queries also. So we have that timestamp on there, and I just saved my record. Nothing happened. Let's go ahead and force a concurrency failure. So I'm going to edit this user in two windows. So I opened up a new window. I can close this one. And we'll say Mary has moved to that Main Street. This record is going to save just fine. And let me make sure I'm debugging here. I am. This record has the old concurrency token on it. This is the old value here. So I'm going to save it. And this is exactly what I see. It throws an exception, DB update concurrency exception. Now, I was talking before about this cool stuff that you can do with action filters. And I'll show you web forms too. But with the action filters in MVC, I've included these in the code download. I have two of them. One of them was for MVC3 to catch those DB entity validation exceptions and map them to values on the page. Secondly, is I have this concurrency exception filter. And the way that you install this or use this is you include the code. And MVC allows you to have global action filters. So if we go to our MVC project into our global ASAX, when my application starts up here, I'm registering my concurrency exception attribute. And what this says is anywhere in the application that throws this exception, I want you to parse some data and do some cool stuff for me. And what's that cool stuff? Let's go ahead and finish running this, F5. So the filter does this. I don't have to handle any of this on the page. This, again, is part of aspect-oriented programming. We're using these aspects to handle common functionality we want to do in our application. So that action filter is completely responsible for this. I don't have this code anywhere in my controller. If I look at my customer controller, oops, that was my edit method. I don't have that concurrency code in here anywhere. This is all handled because of that global action filter. And what does it do? It says, hey, the record you've attempted to edit was modified by another user. Great message to the user. Let them know something's going on here. The edit operation was canceled. In other words, your changes were not yet saved. The current values have been displayed. Very powerful. It lets the user see what other people are doing in the application right now. Maybe two of you hit save at the same time, and it shows you all the difference in fields. And you can do that simply by including that action filter and going to your global ASAX, including this one line of code. So very pluggable. With web forms, you have to catch this exception manually and your DB entity validation exceptions. So web forms, if I'm going to add a new customer, and I'm going to use, let's say, an object data source, you get these different events that get called. Let me go to the code here. I'm not doing that on my screen. Flashing like crazy. So on inserted, call this method. There's my delete method. And what happens is there are several ways of doing this. You need to make sure that that exception is there in web forms. And you can simply check if your event args exception does not equal null. And I just have a little code here, check for any framework exceptions. And in that, I do one of two things. I say, have there been any concurrency validations, exceptions? If there happen to be, then I do something similar. It's not as slick as the MVC, but I do display an error message here. The record was edited, modified by another user. And I use the built-in page validators to add that message to the page. Secondly, if it's a DB entity validation exception, then we get a little bit smarter here. And for every validation exception, we just add it to the page validators. So if you're using web forms and you want to use concurrency and validation, download this code, and you just need this wherever you're checking your exceptions. And that will handle it just fine. And try to parse your page and add your validator so the users kind of see what's going on. So it's definitely possible in web forms. It's just not quite as smooth, but definitely possible there. Now, so when we save this again, we now have the current concurrency token. And it's going to save it to the database. And away we go. And it does its own checks. You can see it does the update here. It sends in our command. And then it grabs the latest timestamp. When it does the update, it makes sure that you're updating that customer ID and that you're updating only that current timestamp. So it's kind of almost using two keys to update your record. And then it tries to determine if there's been any updates or not. If not, it throws an exception, as we saw. So again, using the mini profiler, we could just see the code, what's going on. It helps you look into what's going on behind the scenes with Entity Framework, which really helps understand it. The last feature Ah, I'm sorry. Go back one other thing. With web forms, if you want to use the concurrency, you need to include that timestamp somehow. What if you're using a grid view? In the grid view, that's easy. You simply specify your keys. And let me just run this so you can see it. Oops, I don't want to do that. Set as start project. My right-click A is not working. So set as default. Oh, you know why? Because I'm in the middle of running. OK, set a startup project. Let's run this. It needs to include those keys behind the scenes. And in this grid that it will generate, we need to tell it, include the timestamp and the customer ID. And the way that you do that is you simply tell it here, data key names, customer ID, and timestamp. And that will make all the pieces fit together. Now again, WebForms does some work for you, so it's hard to understand kind of everything that's going on here. But the same thing can happen. Oops. We go grab this. Let's do some sort of concurrency validation here. We're going to edit Mary here. We're going to make her exciting again. And we're going to come here. Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't edit her first. Edit. And edit. Make her not exciting. And over here, we're going to make her exciting. And we can get the same exact concurrency checks here. So very possible in web forms. You just need to make sure you include that timestamp in your grid or on your page somewhere. How long left? 10 minutes. Perfect. An awesome feature they added to 4.3. Made me very happy, and I think several angels got their wings when they added this. What happens if you're using the code-first model and you need to make code changes? My question when I saw this a year ago was, all right, so I add a social security number to a user record. Now what? How does that get back out to the database? Well, there's nothing there for that yet. There is now. So we can migrate our model changes back out to the database, which is very powerful, as we'll see. So enable to do the migrations. Let's go to a project to have them on. We call, from that package manager console I showed you before, enable migrations dash enable automatic migrations. And then you call update database. And that will automatically push it to the database. Hold on, Adam, you say, that's not cool. My DBA is going to beat me up. Because I just don't want these changes getting pushed out to the database. Or if I push them out to the dev environment, how do I get them out to production? We don't want to use Visual Studio to push these changes out to production. How do I know everything it's doing? And there's some options around that. This is neat. Let's go back to our web project. And we're going to change this compile, and we're going to change our customer object. I was serious when I said, I'm going to add a social security number here. That's so scandalous now. You're only supposed to use other IDs and patient privacy. I'm going to add a social security number. Nobody can stop me. All right. Now, I've added it to my model, but if I run this right now, it's going to say, hey, your model doesn't match the database. Or I've added these changes and I know I want to push this out to production. How do I do that? So you enable your automatic migrations using the one I showed you before, that command that was up there. I've already enabled them for this project, so I'm just going to actually run update database. But I don't want it to update my database. I want it to just tell me what it's doing or what it needs to do. So you can say update database dash script. If you want to see even more information, you can say dash verbose. Update database. And let's have at it. There we go. There's our script. Alter table customer, add social security number, varchar max. OK, you say, varchar max, that is a long social security number. What if I want to do something like this? Social security number, 9 characters. We won't allow dashes. All right. Entity Framework, let's see what you got. Show me the money. Wait for it. Synchronize watches. And there we go. Look at that. So it parses your model validation. This works for Fluent validation as well as your data annotations. This is a stellar feature. Now you give this to your DBA, and DBA is happy, and he might even buy you a beer. What's this guy? Migration history. Entity Framework 4.3 added a table, migration history, __ migration history. You can roll back to prior versions of migrations. Let's say you're going in production, and you're trying to push your changes out. It fails. You can roll back. All of these histories are kept in this table. The name of the migration, and all of your model data essentially gets serialized and gets sent to the database. And Entity Framework can check to make sure that the application you're running matches what's in the database currently. And this is good because maybe another developer has deployed old code. Happens all the time. There's an old library that was floating around and they deployed it out. Entity Framework at runtime will say, uh-uh. The metadata in the database doesn't match your model. That's it. You need to figure something out. In which case, if there really needs to be synchronization, you can just come in here and have it generate the script and update it, or figure out what's going on and grab the old library. So this very easily allows you to do that. If you decide not to make those changes and you just roll them back, and you say, hey, script out everything for me, it's going to tell you there's no changes here. I should have paused. There's no changes here. Right. It just comes up with an empty script file. The other thing that it will do is if you come in here and say, hey, first name is now max length of 5, this is a change, right? I'm shrinking down my first name. Go ahead and do this. Well, what's going to happen in our database? It's going to truncate this data potentially for us. So if I say script, and the framework is smart enough to say, I don't know about that. What's going to happen is you're going to truncate data. There's going to be some sort of data loss. Wait a minute. Hold on here. Something didn't work right for me. No pending code migration. So for some reason, let me go and change my map class real quick. Oh, you know what? I'm already specifying here that my first name has a max length of 50. Let's change this here to 5. So I kind of had dual validation attributes going on. Compile that. And we run this. Take off our force flag, because I'll show you what that is in 1 second. And automatic migration was not applied because it would result in data loss. This is good. This is what I want to see. Well, what if I know I want that data loss? Then you can just simply specify dash force. And it will generate that script for you. It's not actually forcing a change to the database. You're just saying, get around your little error message and generate the script for me. And there we go. Alter table. And it shrinks it down to 5 characters and adds your new metadata. Same thing. Required field can be handled just fine. In one case, it's going to say it'll migrate them as null or not null. If you have a required field that is no longer required, it's going to alter table and just make it, instead of having not null there, where it was null, now it's just going to be not null.
Well, the other way around, you added the field Social Security, right? It's a required field, and the table already has data.
Oh, the script that it generates, I believe in those cases, I think it does, it adds a default with quote, quote. Now, to be more specific there, what you can do is you can actually seed your data. You can tell Entity Framework you have a seed method. And in here, you can specify smarter stuff to do with all of your entities. Oh, I'm sorry. Silly me. So you have this seed method right here. And in here, you can specify any sort of custom thing. In addition, you can just modify the script that it generates for you if you want any other defaults that are filled into there. I don't believe so. I think renaming is just going to come in as a drop for the old column and then whatever for the new column. In that case, you'd have to modify the script because it wouldn't know that one is actually renamed now. Migration history is hit when your app domain loads for the first time. And you'll see that when you, if you use like IntelliTrace or the mini profiler, that first request, when you run it, you'll see there's like four queries executed, and you'll see kind of the metadata stuff going on, and then that's it until that app domain's done and loads up again. So thank you. Here's a couple blog entries I'm going to have up probably tomorrow, one for using dependency injection with any framework, unit of work pattern, and some other links there. Again, Twitter, Adam Tulliper. If you have any questions, I'll be here for a few minutes afterwards, or shoot me off an email. And thank you very much, and enjoy the rest of your TechEd.